Welcome to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. I'm one of your hosts, Shannon Grimes, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Blaine. Also joining us for this episode is the incomparable Amber Kinnison.
Hello!
Up for discussion this month is In the Mood for Love.
So hopefully everybody is in the mood for this conversation.
Oh, yeah. We forgot to mention that Blaine has lots of terrible puns in his little pouch.
So. I do. I can't help myself. Well, In the Mood for Love was released in the year 2000. It is directed and written by Wong Kar-wai and is really the film that helped him make his way onto the international scene in a very big way. It's a film that almost defies description due to the emphasis Wong Kar-wai places on ellipsis and elliptical editing, which are a couple of his signature techniques. But the film is centered around two neighbors, Mrs. Chan and Mr. Chow, who discover that their spouses are having an affair with one another. Then, broken by this discovery, the two form a close friendship, yet remain adamant that they won't make the same mistake as their respective spouses. So I mentioned just briefly a second ago that this film defies description, and maybe that's a good place to start with our discussion, because a simple plot description of In the Mood for Love makes the film sound like a typical American melodrama. But of course, it's anything but that. So Amber, why don't you start us off by talking about some of the ways that this movie is different from other love stories we may be used to?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I kind of want to even take a step back and start with like how it's different from other films we're used to, because, you know, it's far from typical. that's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, right? I mean,
yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Like, very much so, yeah. Definitely.
It's so special to me just because I love it so much, but it's so different. And I think what sets it apart, utilizing the visual storytelling aspect of film, you know, to its fullest, and really, really utilizing film as a visual art form.
Mm-hmm.
It's a work of art, you know. It's not just a story. It's not just a movie. It is a work of art on absolutely every level, for so many reasons, including a lot of technical reasons. I mean, I was really looking at shot compositions and the way they were using the camera and the way they were using design principles in the film. And, I mean, you could do a whole, you know, film course, you could do a whole class on this one movie and how design and, you know, camera work are used to tell this story. I mean, it's all so just beautifully executed to evoke all of these really complicated emotions, mm-hmm. In the viewer and really get you to feel everything that they're feeling, you know, this sense of just, I mean, there's so much, you know, there are so many secrets and there's all this yearning, but there's restraint and then the isolation of everybody. I mean, but then it's all conveyed visually and that's not easy. You know, those are really complicated things to convey, in a visual way. And he gets it all in there.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible.
Yeah. We noticed one of the first things I noticed was after about 5 or 10 minutes, I was like, you know, I feel kind of disoriented right now because I mm-hmm. haven't seen like a larger than, you know, 3 square foot area in the entire movie so far. And it's really hard. Like I feel trapped already. And you know,
we're just like the characters.
Amazing how they did that.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's really, his use of close-ups is very, very unsettling. And especially, I mean, I think when you have the two protagonists, you hardly have a shot with them together where they're not in close-up, or even separate. They're always...
Or even... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, one thing that struck me is that, you know, because it is you know, it's so much about their being kept apart, you know, because the love affair that never was, because they don't actually get together. And so it, yeah, spoilers. But, so what struck me is that there are so many times when you don't see them together on screen. They're interacting or they're just passing by, but they're not actually in the frame at the same time. Either he's on the other side of the doorway or she walks out of the frame and then he walks into the frame like a few seconds later. So yeah. it's all these, like, you know, you just get this sense of like these fleeting moments, and they rarely even touch. Mm-hmm. They're often just either brushing past one another, you know, brushing their hands against one another, you know, so it's all of these fleeting things, but that he uses slow motion in such an effective way. He uses it a lot, and it's almost like hypnotic the way he uses it. Mm-hmm. Wong Kar-wai, I mean, the director.
Yeah.
And he, but yeah, he slows down all of these fleeting moments between them, and it really, it makes it, you know, it gives you this kind of lingering sense of like, you know, they wish they could be there longer, but you know, it's all very fleeting.
Yeah,
it's interesting that those use of close-ups, that is some influence by Robert Bresson, who is famous for his use of close-ups. But it's interesting because Wong Kar-wai really uses close-ups in this film to express emotions and actually help you experience the emotions these characters are. Whereas mm-hmm. Bresson famously used close-ups to distance his viewers from the characters. So that's an interesting sort of reversal there that Wong Kar-wai plays with. There's also a ton of frames within frames in this film.
Yeah, he uses windows and doorways and hallways and mirrors and yeah.
So many mirrors.
Yeah. Which is another way that we feel trapped. We feel trapped like these characters. There's a little bit of film noir influence in there too, with lots of blinds, you know, casting shadows on walls and characters.
A lot of shadow.
Yep. So yeah, I think this also calls attention to a couple of the film's more significant themes that we'll probably talk about later: memory and the passing of time. So formally,
well, that's what I was. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. No, oh, that's what I was going to say. Like, I actually wrote down, because it's, you know, it has these kind of poems that divide it up into, mm-hmm. it's not exactly into three acts, because the last two are like just kind of at the end. But the very last one, like the one that ends with, it says, he remembers those vanished years as though looking through a dusty window pane, which we see them looking out windows a lot as well. The past is something he could see but not touch, just like she was, actually. And everything he sees is blurred and indistinct. So there's really this emphasis on distance and inobtainability and sort of kind of, you know, like in the past, like that's gone now and we can't get it back. And it's all, you know, again, that idea of it being fleeting.
Yeah, very much so.
I think one of the things that I noticed, this may be sidetracking a little, but one of the things I also noticed in terms of like things being fleeting and trying to connect with the characters is that we never, you know, actually got a facial, we didn't get to see the faces of their spouses.
No, we never see them.
Which kind of is funny because they spend so much of the movie trying to figure out like how their spouses, you know, got into this situation with each other and got into mm-hmm. this relationship, and it's like distancing us from their actual spouses while we spend so many times going through the scenarios with them like pretending to be their spouses. Mm-hmm. It's another disorienting thing, and I mean it's good, it's a good thing. It's just kind of, it's surreal.
Yeah, well, one thing I was noticing about that too is that a lot of times he'll just kind of jump you into a scene where they're, you know, kind of play acting, but you don't it's very ambiguous. You don't know. You're like, yeah. Wait, is this a real conversation they're having? Mm-hmm. Or are they just in these roles? And then, you know, after a few seconds, it becomes clear like what's going on, but it's like, oh, wait, oh, yeah. Are they saying that to each other right now? It's like, oh, no.
Right.
Okay. But, then, but are like, they, though?
Yeah. No, it, like, makes you wonder. At the end of the movie, you're like, so was the whole thing a dream? Is this Inception?
Like, I'm curious, too, because you mentioned that they don't get together. So one of the things I had written down for us to talk about is the epilogue of the film. And, of course, one of the things that happens in the epilogue is eventually Mr. Chow returns to Hong Kong to the same apartment complex and learns that there is this woman living next door with her son now. He doesn't go in there. And, of course, that woman is Mrs. Chang and a son that she's gone on to have. And I guess there's two ways to look at it. That son could be her son with her husband that she later split up with. Or it could be they could have actually gotten together at some point that we didn't see and carried through on their act, and they have a son that he doesn't know about.
So what's your opinion on that? Tell us what you think of that.
Man, I don't think so. I think it's her husband's because, I mean, we know that she refused to leave him. And also, I feel like that would kind of cut the legs out from under everything that Wong Kar-wai was portraying in the movie. I feel like that would go against his thesis, as it were, of the entire film. As far as, you know, this idea of kind of this oppressed, almost oppressive, like self-restraint. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea of yearning, like that was the word that kept coming to my mind, yearning. Mm-hmm. And there's no release, until the very end, the very last scene, which is, I could gush about this whole thing forever, but that very last scene is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. When he's at Angkor Wat in Cambodia and, you know, he kind of takes after this old tale where, you know, people would hike up a mountain and carve a hole in a tree and whisper their secrets into the hole and then cover it over with mud. And then we see him do that at the temple. And it's the most open space that we see in the entire movie. You know, because the whole thing, it's, you know, all these secrets in these dark corners and tight spaces and everything. And then they open it up when he finally kind of unburdens himself of this secret and whispers it and then covers it over with mud and then walks away. And it's the most open space we see. So to me, like, that's the release. I don't think it happened earlier. I don't think there was any release from everything that they were both having to keep bottled up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think I tend to agree with you. Shannon, you do as well. We were talking about this,
yeah,
right? Yeah. It's interesting, though, because other people are very adamant about the fact that they actually did get together.
You know, that's because people are suckers for the easy thing, and they want people to be together.
it's really interesting. And I guess you can point to their final conversation where they say that we have become exactly like our spouses.
Yeah.
And you can say that has a very literal interpretation.
Well, which is why he's leaving. Anyway.
So it's interesting. I love that there is that bit of ambiguity built in there again for you to sort of read into it.
Yeah, which I'm like, okay. I mean, okay, maybe, yes, that is a plausible theory and you can go and have that theory, but I don't agree with it.
I think The only thing that I thought would indicate that they had gotten together was one scene towards the end of the movie that was, like, strangely focused on her stomach. I don't know if you remember. Like, they're, like, walking along, and it may just have been, you know, him not wanting to show their faces or emotions or whatever. But it was, like, a minute just staring at her stomach as they walked along. And I was like, at that point in the movie, I was like, wait, is she pregnant? And then at the end of the movie.
If you remember, that's actually a bookend because he shoots them that same way, that same shot angle when they first go to dinner and then they first start to reenact, like, oh, how did this get started between our spouses?
Uh-huh.
It's the same shot. And she's wearing even a very similar dress. So he's just bookending. It's like a visual bookend.
Yep.
Except like the second time, like, okay, this is real. Like the first time we see that, you know, that shot, that scene, it's the same street. It's every, you know, it's all the same. It's pure like play acting. And then the second time it's all real.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And again, I love how he plays with time in this film.
Yeah. You don't always know how much time has passed. There's so much ambiguity.
There is. And it's another reason that I've come very close, tongue in cheek, several times to changing the slogan of this podcast, because for the main real world theology, it's story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. I've come really close to just saying story is overrated sometimes. because sometimes it is. This is a film, but the story really, whatever. The story isn't what holds an attraction about this film for me. And I think for a lot of viewers, it's because there is all of this stuff built in. And yes, it is an interesting story. Story is important, but it's the way Wong Kar-wai sort of what the life he breathes into that story.
Yeah, the way it's told is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do we? I guess because I love the Decemberists, I have to borrow. I have to borrow a term from one of their album titles. This film has a lot to say about the hazards of love. So, Amber, how do you understand or even interpret the relationship between these two protagonists? There's a way to, I think, look at it as something very, at least in its outset, very innocent and naive and sweet, even. And then there's a darker way to look at it. What do you think?
Just their relationship itself?
Yeah, even the idea of them starting up a relationship. This whole idea they have that they can do this thing and not fall into the same trap.
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, I think you can see they're passing ships a lot, you know, in the street, in the building, you know, they pass each other by all the time. You know, then she's starting to, you know, she borrows books from him and all of this. So they do have these little moments. So then when they both discover that their spouses are unfaithful, and we see that they are pretty lonely and isolated people, you know, in their respective workplaces, you know, we see them working alone a lot. And it's interesting that we see her aiding and abetting her boss in his own affair and doing the same jerky pitfalls mm-hmm. of buying the same present for his wife and his mistress that then their spouses do. But that's a different thing. but anyway, but it's funny that he shows us that, you know, off the bat, and then they start to pick up on it. And But we see that they're lonely, and so then when they're betrayed by, you know, their one person, by their spouse, I feel like it's kind of a logical next step that they would turn to each other to try to figure out how to cope with it. Because who else do they have? I mean, there's no one we see who could help them deal with it. You know, Mr. Chow has got, you know, this one friend who's a total idiot. And he's not going to help you deal with complex emotional problems. Like, he is useless. So, you know, who do they have to turn to? Yeah. And who's going to understand what they're going through? So I feel like, you know, it's kind of the logical next step. Like, oh, well, this person's going through the exact same thing that I'm going through. So, like, who else am I going to talk to? And from there, I think because when they say like, oh, we won't be like them, it's kind of halfway through this progression of, you know, them getting closer and closer. Like, it's not right away. They don't set out saying, oh, well, you know, oh, I'm attracted to you, but we're not going to be like them. You know, I think at first they're really trying to help each other cope.
Right.
And then it intensifies. And I love, you know, again, Wong Kar-wai, this is amazing. But I mean, the colors change. The shot compositions change, like, mm-hmm. as their relationship intensifies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you start to see a lot of red. As their relationship progresses. I mean, blowing in the halls, through the dress that she's wearing, everything is red. it's interesting, too, because Wong Kar-wai has gone on record saying that were these actors not such attractive people, he says that it would be easier to see them and see their sort of project, if you will, in a much darker way, because they're coming, and I'm paraphrasing Wong Kar-wai here, but basically they come together and they concoct this fantasy world where they think that they have mastery over their relationship.
Right.
Because like you said, we don't see them interact a ton. We don't see them touch a ton, but when we do see them talk, probably 80% of the time they're role-playing, even if we don't know it at first. And so they've built up this fantasy world where they think that they're immune to the pitfalls of their spouses, but of course that comes crashing down. So again, it's interesting how much they're, I mean, it's interesting how you can look at this relationship even in different ways.
Yeah. Well, and like even he said, going back to what Amber said, like they didn't mean it to happen. It just happened gradually. Like he even says that when they're trying to figure out how did this happen, he says, well, I guess they just, you know, it didn't happen at a certain time or date. They just gradually fell in love. And then even at the end, you know, they're both crying, or towards the end, and she's like, I didn't expect you to fall in love with me. He's like, I didn't either. And so it's interesting to see how you can try your very darndest to do something, and if it has to do with love, a lot of times you just can't.
Well, what does he say? It says it can creep up on you, or some feelings can creep up on you, or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember.
Well, and what's great is that, you know, because of the play act and everything, and because of all the ambiguity, we don't know either. Like, yeah. I don't know. I watched it twice this week, and I'm like, I still don't know if I can, I don't know if there's a moment where it's like, oh, yeah, there's the turn. You know, he really does capture that sort of just gradual progression. Like, it snuck up on them. And it sneaks up on us. Like, I feel like there's a moment where we can say, oh, okay, it has happened. But it's hard to look back and see when it pivoted from just comfort each other to falling in love with one another. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. And I mean, I think for me, at least, it was difficult to tell reality from the role playing.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, even if something actually happened, like a lot of times when they do a scene twice, I was like, did they like actually sit in the street and like play this through twice? Or like, are they just imagining this? Like that made it harder to tell kind of when they started to fall in love, because you couldn't really tell whether it was them or them playing their spouses or them thinking about playing their spouses or what.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I think that was the point, that it kind of starts to blur in everyone's mind. And we were put so much in their footsteps through the way that every shot was framed, that it starts to become just one big blur.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned earlier the epilogue of the film, specifically the part in Cambodia, which is beautiful, at Angkor Wat. And we get a voiceover from our protagonist in that. I think that really brings this idea of the impermanence of moments, or the fleeting nature of moments versus sort of unchanging reality. Because you have this voiceover with our main character talking about, oh, this sort of slipped through my fingers. I wish this could have happened, this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Opposed to this building that has been there for a long time. And it stood the test of time, unlike their relationship.
Yeah.
Ooh, I didn't think of that.
Contrast.
So I don't know, what else do you like about the epilogue?
Well, I mean, I don't think we covered it. I mean, well, we haven't talked about the music yet.
Oh.
So
yeah, do it.
There's that. Oh my gosh. The Umeji's theme that's used throughout. Again, like, it just makes, you know, it's a waltz, so it's 3/4 time, it's slow, but it's so, again, that hypnotic, like, it's just mesmerizing, you know, to watch, and the, you know, the way he uses slow-mo accompanied with that, and this is all throughout the film, not just in the epilogue, you know, it's just oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. And, you know, for the longest time, I had that song, I would listen to it on repeat every night when I was going to sleep.
It's beautiful.
It's just so, it's so beautiful.
And it's like cathartic. It just makes you like relax. Yeah.
Maybe but not every also, time when you hear it in the film.
Yeah, no. but then as in addition to all the amazingly gorgeous cello music, the use of the Nat King Cole songs is really interesting too. Like his choice is very deliberate. Like the quizás, 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 when they first meet in the restaurant, which translates to perhaps, 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 for those of you who haven't listened to like five different recordings of that song. but yeah, so it's this kind of like, what if, and Tony Long's character, Mr. Chow, he actually asks, he kind of postulates that later. He's like, you know, sometimes I wonder what I'd be or who I would have been if I hadn't married.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, and their whole relationship is kind of a what if. So again, I mean, he just, Wong Kar-wai just does an amazing job of just underscoring all of the themes that he is getting in here through the dialogue, through the imagery, through, you know, camera, like, shot composition and everything, like, you know, just constantly underscoring all of that. It's just superb.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. That's
I really could good. Gush about this movie for a really long time.
I had mentioned earlier that this theme, memory is unreliable, or memory is not always reliable. And we circle back to that at the end again with the voiceover when he says, I'm, you know, staring in a mirror dimly. That's more biblical than what he says, but he says basically the same thing.
Right. The dusty window pane, and then it's blurred and indistinct.
Right. Right. So it's interesting too. We have, again, we have Wong Kar-wai playing with ellipsis where time has passed from scene to scene or from shot to shot sometimes. And we're just sort of left, you know, running to catch up and figure out what's going on and putting all the pieces together ourselves. He's not a director who's just going to spoon feed us everything.
No. Love puts you in a haze.
Yeah. I love that he makes us work for it. And then I'm always really interested when a filmmaker can, in a subtle and artful way, call attention to the filmmaking process, and maybe talk about what film does. So if we're talking about memory as unreliable, I think the use, like I mentioned before, of all these frames within frames, sometimes frames within frames within frames, is calling attention to the filmmaking process as an act of framing life. Wong Kar-wai does this in several of his films. He plays with composition and frame. And so we have this idea that we conceive a film as recording reality truly or honestly or something like that, but that's not what it does all of the time, or even necessarily. Sometimes even that memory of film is false.
Well, I mean, you can take it, it's kind of like taking something out of context. Like if someone said a quote that had the word not in it, and, you know, you filmed everything and edited the not out, it would be a completely different quote. Like you could do that with your memories and remember, you know, the good part of something and not the bad part, even though both were there.
Yeah, absolutely. He's such an interesting filmmaker. And one that, like you said, it's easy to gush about. It's easy to revisit and just find more every single time.
Yeah. So, and
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to touch on, I had a couple more like points about his actual, like the more technical aspect of how, what he does visually. So this is kind of towards the latter part, where he dollies back and forth. Like you see them in their respective apartments. Mm-hmm. Like it's interesting, you know, cause they're neighbors. So it seems like, oh, they should be so close, but he emphasizes their separation. Mm-hmm. You know, he's dollying back and forth between their respective apartments and shooting them through these hallways. And they look so isolated. And you know, the way it's framed, it's very narrow. And then they're just there in the middle and he just dollies back and forth. And it takes us a while. You know, he really emphasized, I'm like talking with my hands right now. You can't even see me.
I imagine it.
So yeah, but you know, he's dolling and they're just both, you know, sitting there alone looking sad. But just that visual device of, you know, it's not just cutting between them. We're slowly moving between them, and we see that separation. The separation becomes very tangible, which is amazing. And then another thing he does is, well, this whole, you know, idea of things being unfulfilled. You know, there are so many shots of, like, unanswered telephones, unopened doors, mm-hmm. You know, somebody does pick up the telephone, there's silence on the other end. When she comes to bring his books back, he's not there. So he like zooms in on them just sitting on the table waiting for them. Like they've missed each other again. So yeah, just this whole, he uses object, like again, this, all this visual art form, visual storytelling. He does it all so well. And he ties so much to just looking at objects.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of smoke. And we see characters tied together with objects too. You know, the whole with exchanging gifts, you know, cause their first connection is, oh, you know, my husband has the same tie. Oh, my wife has the same bag. But we, before they talk about that, we see that in the shots, we see the handbags. You know, we see, Mrs. Chan's at her desk, and then we see the shot in the apartment with, Mrs. Chow, and she has just seen, you know, her lover, and her bag is there on the stand, on the nightstand. So we see, and it's only like, I mean, the shots are very close in proximity as first time. So you remember, you're like, oh, wait, mm-hmm. I just saw that bag and it was not in her possession. That's not right. That's not okay.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in that lonely shot that I was talking about earlier, like he's got the rice cooker that she got for him. And, right. You know, he's obviously thinking about her. So there's just so many visual cues to show us what is happening internally. It's mm-hmm. awesome.
Absolutely. I mean, the added show versus tell is Wong Kar-wai does that.
Oh, he doesn't tell us anything. Yeah, he shows us everything. And the dialogue is so minimal. There's mm-hmm. not a ton of dialogue.
No. Not much at all, especially comparatively. Sometimes I like to imagine I'm a masochist. I like to imagine what this would look like as an American.
Oh,
as an American film, and I think about how terrible it would be.
It would be terrible. Would it get made? It probably would.
It would have to have a lot of other stuff. Let's just say there wouldn't be ambiguity about whether they got together or not.
It would get made, but it would have a different ending.
Yeah. It would be so lame.
Yeah.
And that, you know, one thing that I love about this movie and that I so appreciate about this movie is I feel like in our culture of, we have this culture of self-gratification, maybe I'm being a cynic, but, you know, if you make it happy, do it, you know, that whole thing. So like in our culture of self-gratification, the restraint of these characters amidst their own sort of yearning is so powerful. You know, because I know it's set in the 60s, but still, you know, it's not set in current day. But I think that it's so impactful, and it's really novel to see desire unfulfilled depicted on the screen, because like you said, like that's just not how most people are telling stories these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but that's life. We don't always get what we want.
No.
Yeah.
That's real life. You know, it's, and so I so appreciate that, because, you know, it's like, oh, you know, do what makes you happy, or, oh, like if you want it enough, you'll get it. Or if you try hard enough, you'll get it. Or, you know, if you dream hard enough, you'll get it. Like, that is just not true.
No. Yeah, very true. And it was interesting when we first came out, I have seen this before several times. Shannon had not, she had not seen this until this week. And one of the first things she said when we came out of watching this was that it reminded you of La La Land.
It was.
Oh, I actually haven't seen it.
It's really good. If you like this, you'll like it. I guess in a way, this is like the closest America will probably ever get to remake. But
in terms of dealing with love not gained, sought but not.
Hold on. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen La La Land, you might want to skip ahead like a minute.
We shouldn't spoil it for Amber either.
Oh, you're going to spoil it for me?
I wasn't going to spoil it, but...
Okay.
But, like, it is... I mean, there's beautiful music that, like, impacts your emotions, which is what music is supposed to do, but it impacts your emotions. And then at the end, you know, you just have, you like work with the main characters and their feelings for each other. And it's very, it lingers with you. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I will say that.
It would make for a very interesting, double feature, I think. But yeah, I'm partial to Wong Kar Wai myself.
Interesting.
It's also interesting because looking at Wong Kar Wai's filming style, a lot of times he doesn't. Most of the time when he shoots a film, he doesn't work off of a script.
Right, and I did read that this was the same thing. It was a lot. I mean, I think he had kind of a rough something, but a lot of it was improvised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He usually has like some sort of rough idea and then improvises, which is a lot of the way that Terrence Malick works.
I guess that makes sense it makes sense in a situation like this where you're going for raw emotion because it's hard to be emotional when you're like trying to remember lines. Like it makes a lot more sense as an actor to let it come naturally and be like, what would I do in this situation? Yeah. Not that I'm a polished actor, but you know, from my fifth grade plays and stuff.
Well, and certainly if you can find actors that you are comfortable working with, and he's worked with both of these actors, and has gone on to work with them again. So they certainly have a rapport. I think it's maddening to some actors to work that way, but definitely if you can find a good fit, then it can certainly bring out a very good performance.
Yeah.
So other thoughts, Amber?
Let's see. Another thing about shots. One thing I noticed, a lot of the time, again, with emphasizing their separation and kind of the boundaries, a lot of the shots, even especially, I think especially when their relationship starts to intensify, their wedding band is very visible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking mm-hmm. specifically of the scene. There's no dialogue. It's all music. But they're in that apartment, like working on his writing, and you just see them talking and eating and all of that. But all these shots, you know, then Tony Leung has his hand up with his cigarette, and we see his wedding band, and then we see them eating, and you know, Maggie Cheung has food in her hand, and we see her in the mirror, and we see that wedding band. And then a lot of times, like we'll see, you know, see them standing in a doorway and their hand is up on the door frame and you can see their wedding band. So, you know, it's very, very deliberate in showing, like, you know, we think, oh, this is progressing. And it's like, nope, brick wall. Like, you know, it will only go this far and it will stop. Again, just like emphasizing, like,
yeah,
they're separate. Like this is mm-hmm. not, you know, we're keeping them apart.
So close, yet so far.
So close, yet so far. And then, let's see. The show and don't tell thing, again, I love the scene where they go to dinner for the first time because he's like, I want to ask you something. And they basically are putting the pieces together that their spouses are having the affair with one another. Right. You know, he's like, you know, where'd you get your bag? Oh, my wife has one just like it. But they never, she asks him like, what are you getting at exactly? And then it cuts to them walking in the street, after it lingers, of course, a little bit. And then it says, she said, I thought I was the only one who knew. So they never say, you know, oh, our spouses are having an affair, you know, again, not insulting right. our intelligence or anyone's intelligence, like, you know, oh, he's cheating with your wife and she's cheating with my husband. Like that is never spoken.
Mm-hmm.
It's left up to you.
The complexity of emotion that is in this film is, again, one of the things that makes it really intriguing and makes you want to revisit it. So one of the first scenes, I think it's the first scene where they're doing their role play and they're trying to imagine how it started. And mm-hmm. so they each take turns in their different role. They end up actually in a fight at the end of that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to just think about why, because initially he's role playing as the husband, and so he initiates it, and she says no, my husband would never say that, and he says, well, somebody had to start it had to be him, and that doesn't make her happy. So it's interesting, even as they're upset at their spouses, and they're upset about the situation, they're still getting mad at one another, even through their role playing. That happens several times when they're doing that.
Yeah, it's. I feel like it's very raw in that way.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Well, Amber, I think we could keep talking about this for a long time.
Forever.
But, right. We are running up on time for this month's episode. So thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun to have you on.
And, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you tell everyone where they can find you on social media?
Oh, let's see. So I am a contributor for Real World Theology. So, you know, realworldtheology.com. Find reviews there. Do new releases and classics and stuff in between. So, and then I'm in the Real World Theology Facebook discussion group. So you can find me on there. And then, other than that, I am an artist. So you can find my work on Instagram and on Tumblr.
Very good art.
That is everywhere. Oh, thanks, Shannon.
that's everywhere we can find you.
I believe so.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everyone else for listening. We want to hear what you think about In the Mood for Love. The easiest way to do that is by joining that Real World Theology discussion group on Facebook. And also, if you've enjoyed the show, please take a second to subscribe on iTunes and leave us a rating and review. That wraps things up for us here. So until next month, thanks for rewinding with us.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!